Welcome to Saturday Mornings with Joy Keys. I'm your host, Joy Keys. I want to thank you so much for tuning in. You can follow me on Twitter at Joy Keys, or you can become a fan on Facebook. Just look up Saturday Mornings with Joy Keys. Also, I'm on Instagram now. You can check me out, tag me Saturdays with Joy Keys. I want to say thank you so much for tuning in. Close to 860,000 downloads of the podcast. Could not have done that without your support. Thank you so much for tuning in. This interview is a pre-recorded interview with award-winning Kenyan author Yvonne Adhiambo Uwor about her book Dust. So please stay tuned. Unfortunately, we'll not be able to call in, but I will be giving away copies of the book Dust, so stay tuned on Twitter, Facebook, or Instagram to learn how to win a copy of her book Dust.
I just want to say thank you so much for agreeing to do the interview, Yvonne.
You are welcome.
Let me tell the audience a little bit about you. You were born in Kenya, and you received the Kain Prize for African Writing for your short story, Weight of Whispers, in 2003. Also, you were Woman of the Year by Kenya's Eve magazine, and you are not only a novelist, but you are were a screenwriter because you were the executive director of the Zanzibar International Film Festival from 2003 to 2005.
Yes, I was.
So I want to start at the beginning. Why writing? Why not filmmaking? Why not being a doctor? Why not being a gardener? Why writing?
Well, I've meandered through a whole lot of other, professional options, experimented with IT. I was a bit of a nerd there. And tried my hands at corporate communications. Meandered, like I said, across these options and professions, including event organization, as I did in Zanzibar. But at the heart of everything was the longing and desire to write. I've always written. But it took a long, long time to be able to acknowledge it as a passion and as something that I could do and live with.
So do you feel that you are a political writer? Because many of your stories, the story you won the Kain Prize for and this book, Dust, is heavy in politics. Do you think you would continue that?
No,
do you think you would continue?
Characters, I blame it all on the characters. They're political. It wasn't me.
It wasn't you. It was a spirit. A spirit overtook you. Yes, a spirit overtook
yes.
you and made you write it. So let's start talking about the title, the book Dust. The book Dust. People are thirsty. I mean, I felt thirsty. You know, reading the book, I was like, "Where's my bottle?" Where's my bottle, plastic bottle of water, because I felt thirsty. But they're also not just thirsty for water. They're thirsty for the truth. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Oh, that's what a beautiful insight. I hadn't thought of it that way. Yes, the hunger, mm-hmm. as you say, the thirst for the core of truth. And it's a search, isn't it? In the book, and it's a challenging search because it requires looking very deeply within, and perhaps you know when you talked about the political aspect, I guess the inspiration of the Kenyan landscape and the Kenyan emotional landscape, particularly where we struggle as a nation, we tend to struggle with. Faces of truth. I guess the book implies that whether we like it or not, it's a quest that must be undertaken in order to find life.
Yeah, you also are dealing with a lot of secrets. Everyone seems to have a secret. Even if they don't know they have a secret, then they find out they have a secret, you know? And people are so hiding everywhere, you know? Do you feel as a culture there are a lot of secrets because of corruption in the government politics? Do you feel there are a lot of secrets?
I think almost like that's at least the idea of not confronting something that one is uncomfortable with, that perhaps reflects on one's humanity, is a human situation. The secrets are linked to the things that you, I guess, in the book, in the story, the things that people have done, you know, maybe crimes against humanity, or crimes against themselves, or crimes against the family, or crimes against the nation, that are, when you take a step back, are too horrific to comprehend. So what you try to do is you silence it. You create a kind of collective amnesia. But I imagine that's a thing that the human being is particularly good at doing.
Yes, I think we are too, because it's a form of protection, as you said, to keep going. Your book deals with the Mau Mau uprising, where more than 12,000 people died, maybe even more than that, because people's bodies weren't found. That's very difficult to digest, what happened, the massacre that happened. Could you talk to the audience a little bit about the Mau Mau uprising?
The book actually looks at it from a different perspective. The thing that is unspoken is the fact that in the description of the Mau, the state narrative of the Mau Mau, and the narrative which we have preferred to imbibe is the idea of a national uprising. But I was struck by a conversation I had with somebody who lived through the Mau Mau season, who talked about the horror of internal family brokenness, the choices individuals made and then turned against themselves, against their own family. Most of the deaths were caused it was like Mau Mau versus members of the of a family, rather than directed against, at that time, the perceived oppressor, the English. So I always wondered, I think as a Kenyan, at one point I had to ask, what happens when the family feud is silenced? How do people cope when you are living with your uncle, whom you know murdered your grandfather and others who refused to take an oath, and after it's all over, everybody says, okay, let's silence this and everything is fine? How does a society cope with those particular silences, especially when you know that the murder has happened within, when you know you're dealing with fratricide and that kind of thing? And then how does the state collude in the, if you want, the erasure of the more painful personal narrative of a situation?
Yeah, you definitely deal with that. I think it's similar to, say, unfortunately, I related to child abuse. If someone in the family abuses a child and people know, but then they silence it and they silence the child and they keep on going like nothing happened, you know?
Yes.
Yeah. Yes. It's a really difficult situation.
The ghost is there, isn't it? The ghost, the awareness, the idea that there's something not right in the image of perfection. So I was curious. I was looking at that ghost particularly.
Well, you also talk about, and you have a lot of parallels between reality and your book. You know, you open the book with a death of what would be considered almost the main character, because everybody is connected to this young man, Odidi. Mm-hmm. And it reminded me of the assassination of Tom Mboya.
Yeah.
I'm not sure if you were making that connection, yes?
Yeah, it was wasn't intended, but it's interesting. A lot of people have made that connection. I hadn't intended it.
Sometimes it happens. You know, the ghosts take over your writing. You can't control it.
They do.
So where do you write? What is your, do you sit next to a desk? Do you listen to music? Are you outside? Where do you create your artistic endeavors? Where do you create?
I guess I'm going to say everywhere, but I tend to avoid, it actually does depend on the book, and the book brings a particular discipline. So Dust was a layback in bed in your night clothes in the middle of the day and rather than cushion. But I do need music, and sometimes I need art galleries or art books, walk. I do need particularly for Dust, I somehow needed water.
Mm-hmm.
I need a view. I need a sight of green. I need the sight of nature near me in order to create.
Well, you have a lot of the landscape, and that's one of the fights that was happening, is the fight over land appropriation. You know, the British came in and took the land from the Kenyans and took very fertile lands. Almost, I think I was reading like 7 million acres of land the colonial government took from the Kenyan people. And one of your characters is a white English male, comes and has a great land. And as I was reading, I said, you know, this is someone who didn't know any history would say, this is odd. How did this white man get all this land in the middle of Kenya, you know? And then not only that, but the – go ahead, sorry.
No, there's no way else. Maybe I was poking at other ghosts. If you looked a little bit at the history of Kenya as well, most of us are immigrants. Even the Kenyans, even the African Kenyans, Black Kenyans are immigrant races and immigrant
mm-hmm.
nations into this particular landscape. And so at some of the subtext, some of the things we don't talk about as a nation is the idea of prior land ownership, or also when we have our pastoralist nations that have a different idea of who owns land, the idea that land is held in trust and cannot be owned by a person. That's the most ridiculous idea, that a person can own land.
Mm-hmm.
And that clashes with a kind of agricultural mentality that says, own land, build fences, and stand as king of your castle. So these become part of the contradictions that push and pull within the Kenyan state, and that's kind of what was also hinted at in the book.
Yes, well, here in America, you know, the history of the Native Americans and the settlers coming and, you know, having Thanksgiving and then taking the land and bringing disease and, strife to the Native Americans. The question becomes, the Native Americans also took a different view of the land. You know, they took care of the land so that the land would feed them. You know, it wasn't like it was their land, like, you know, borders all the time. It was more, you know, Mother Earth is here to provide for us, but we have to take care of Mother Earth. So that is true. The view of land ownership is an issue not just in Kenya, but in many other places, you know, around the globe.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
One of the things that how your characters deal with art. You are an artist, and one of the Odidi's sister, Ajani, is a
yeah.
painter. You know, Q Bolton is a painter,
yeah.
and then how they're dealt with. Ajani's family was very harsh. I almost cried. The parents burned her pictures.
Yeah.
How were you experienced? How did your family take you becoming a writer or artist?
Oh, they're such darlings. They have no choice. They've given birth to several artists. it's an organic part of who we are as a family. But I guess it's been a long journey in terms of embracing art as a serious option of making a living or fulfilling one's life purpose. Not just as a family. I've been lucky in the family I have. But as a society and as a nation, so that's part of the reason it took a long, long time to be able to admit to myself that the one thing that would really, really make me happy is to be able to write and to experience myself and grow in my art as a writer. Yeah, but the scene you refer to, of course, is that it's playing on the idea. We grew up. There was a time in Kenya where the artists were under pressure and were regarded as political creatures. No matter what they did, whether they sang or painted, they were immediately branded as political rebels. So, but when the state itself was terrified of this form that they could not control and could not understand, and they had a capacity, very strange examples. They would see a painting and would see all sorts of political connotations attached to it, even if it always seemed to just be a red squiggle. I think it's the kind of thing that the Ajahn's parents experience with her art. They see the thing they have hidden. They see the ghost they have kept hidden in the cave.
Yeah, that was really traumatic because my family have a lot of artists as well, musicians, theater, you know, painters, poetry. So I said, oh, my God. Oh, I said, oh, no, what's going to happen? I just knew, like, as I was reading, as I was getting closer to the scene, I was like, oh, my God, what did they do? What, oh, my God, you know, but you also have love in the story. You have a lot of love stories, and not just male-female love, but the story of the brother and sister, Odidi and Ajani, a beautiful, beautiful, I mean, I wish my brother was like that. I mean, you know, he's my brother, but not like I want Odidi to be my brother, you know, to protect to care for me, you know. It was so nice. It was so beautiful, you know. The story, briefly, I'll tell the audience, there's a story where Ajani's stuck in the tree because she's being teased, you know, by the classmates. And, you know, most people would be yelling, come down, you know, get down, you know, I'll take care of it. He goes up into the tree, you know. He goes up into the tree to save her. Like, wow, that's awesome.
I'm glad.
You also have different illicit love stories going on. I don't want to give the plots away, but there are many people who are sleeping with other people that they're not supposed to be sleeping with. that causes conflict, you know, and dissent and silence. There's a lot of silence also in the book. There's a lot of quiet moments for alone or just quiet in the landscape. Do you feel, as a country, that goes back to the secrets and being silent, so there's no noise, there's no energy going on, so to speak, but there's energy, but not the typical energy, you know?
I imagine it was an exploration of the different types of silences. They're the toxic silences that hide things. But then there's the silences where one can retreat. You retreat into silences that heal and re-energize. And amidst the sea of so much noise, I was probably wondering, can something be retrieved from those how would one put them, oases of stillness? Can what do they say? What do they offer?
Well, you also didn't just write a straight novel. You have poetry and the staccato are points of the writing. And also you added some different languages into the novel. Some Kenyan writers only write in their native language. You chose to have a mixture. Do you see yourself writing maybe all in one language other than non-English language in the future?
No, I think I write I hope I write as a Kenyan, and we are a very multilingual, multicultural society. From the time we're born, we negotiate different languages and different ways of being and different cultures right from the beginning. So it's not difficult to run into a Kenyan who will converse with you in English, will turn to his friend and say something in Kiswahili, and call his mother up and speak to her in Luo, while using Sheng to, pass on a message to his friend, and all that in the space of 5 minutes. I guess I'm a creature of my context in that way.
Yes. Now, also, let's talk about the fact that there's a mental health issue here in dealing with death. I mean, Ajani almost loses her mind, and I was trying to follow, at the point I was like, okay, is she going to completely slip? Ajani is the sister of Odidi. Odidi was killed in the beginning of the book, and she almost just, like, almost fell off the edge,
Yeah.
But you brought her back, you brought her back when the truth. And that's the interesting part. She came back, I believe, when she found out the truth,
Yeah. Ah, beautiful. I love the way I love the way you framed that. That's true.
Yeah.
That is true.
I mean, how do Kenyans deal with mental health issues? And let's talk about that, because in America, for African Americans, people try to silence that, try not to deal with that. They don't want to go to therapy. They don't want to talk to anyone. People say talk to your pastor, talk to your grandmother, but let's not go talk to a doctor. It'll pass. Don't worry about it. How do you think Kenyans, and this is a general statement, deal with mental health issues? Because her mom also is – sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, go on.
Her mom also is dealing with issues, and wanders off all the time. I don't want to give away why she's doing these things, but, can you talk to me about the mental health, how that's being, handled?
Okay. I think there are two ways. So the idea of a society straddling world, there are cultural spaces and methods that are not necessarily easily accessible. So the wandering away would have been an outlet in certain societies, a certain way of coping, of entering into other spaces in order to find succor or strength or balance, and then you return. For Jan, when you described African American society and the kind of idea of engagement with mental health, it's very, very similar in kind of the contemporary Kenyan space. Pretty much a thing you don't talk about, or sort of like we're a bit stoic, the kind of like stoic and vestiges of England, stiff upper lip, kind of,
Yes, yes.
Straighten up and cope.
Right.
Yes. Don't wallow.
Buck it up. Suck it up and just keep moving. But then that can cause problems. Like her father, he's also had some issues, and pain that he's been holding in, because of the trauma he had to deal with. So much trauma. He has a lot of different things going on. The murders, the burying of people and body parts, relationship trauma, I can't give that away. I have to hold my tongue. You are very good at, you tricked me. I'm mad at you because you tricked me. I was like, oh my God, no. Is that, oh my God, why did she, oh. So I encourage the readers to read the book because you think you know what's going to happen. You think, oh, this is that. Yvonne tricks you. She's a trickster. Like the traitor. Like traitor. Okay, let's talk about traitor a little bit. Traitor, I didn't know traitor was real or not real. Was he a spirit or was he not a spirit? Talk to me about traitor, the traitor character.
I think it's almost the character of the trickster. In a lot of stories, isn't there? The mythological trickster character, the one that is, with a person operating with moral ambiguity, I loved when I went to Northern Kenya. I met one of those who would be called a Dudani, the trader kind of character. You know, mm-hmm. multi-purpose goods, anything you want, he has it available. And it feels like an in-between man. Very fascinating. I wish I had more time. Scary yet a fascinating person who seemed to, stride across different worlds and realms and things that you, one, did not quite understand. The characters like those, and I just thought, when I run into that person, he had to work his way into the story somehow. Of course, I exaggerate his capacity and skills in the book a little, in order that he become who he became in the book, but. They were, you run into someone like that and say, you're beautiful.
Yeah, no, it's like he blew dust in their faces, in a sense, if you will. Poof, and he made them think what he wanted them to think, but he also pulled out their secrets, and he's always asking people about their secrets, and tell me your secrets, I'll trade you for something, for a secret. So it's a beautiful, beautiful story. How long did it take you to write? Because it's almost 400 pages. How long did it take you to write the story?
Well, it started off in 2005, and it was a completely different story then. It emerged out of the humus of the Kenyan referendum and the stuff that was going on, the things people were saying but not saying. The initial characters emerged out of that. And it was almost written at that time as a kind of, it's the first time I became very aware of the trembling of the secrets, the volcanic impact of what all secrets might cause. And I was afraid that our country was going to detonate, like explode, which it did in 2007, 2008. After that, the story changed again. And within that was also my learning the craft in a very hard way. The story itself was a very humbling process. So the first story I wrote read like a treatise on I don't know what. It was very difficult, and I had very good friends tell me, Yvonne, this is crap. So I had a personal crisis. Am I doing the right thing? Shouldn't I be doing other things? Maybe I need to apply for marketing director or something. Anyway, so that kind of crisis. But then went back to the story 2007 when we approached the Abyss as a nation, and the story acquired more characters and a different kind of urgency. But also in the process, I had to learn from the story how to allow the characters to tell their own story rather than have me impose stories upon them. So it took, so I'd say from 2005 to its release to 2013.
I wish the characters could read your book, because your book is a map for them. But it's a map, it has twists and turns. We have hills, we have valleys, we have, times where we have to rest, to regroup. If the characters could read the book, they would be better off. Instead, they have to take all the different lands, go into the cave, come out the cave, go to the city, go to the country, go out the country, they waste a lot of time, but it's good for the reader, it's good for the reader. Real quickly, let me just ask your opinion. Your book is talking about the strife within the country, but now because of Somalia and the rebels and things, they're coming. You're having a lot of attacks from outside. Last year, the mall attack happened. Do you think you'll be writing a book about that strife now because the attacks from outside? And what do you think about that?
The new book I'm actually working on does feature the Somali pirates, but it's actually, I guess it's sympathetic to them only because I've known that story for a long time, living in the coast. But I don't know yet. I don't know yet. If the inspiration does come, I will. And I'm not pro war. I'm not in support of our troops, the Kenya troops in Somalia. Only because that the idea of violence and violence visited by one people to another just appalls me. But I wonder if, yes, the attacks are coming, but I keep wondering if there may be another way. I don't know yet. Maybe it's too idealistic, but I wonder if there may be another way of dealing, of hearing, of learning what lies beneath this. Because I'm a strong believer in the capacity of the human being to be and do good, and which good also means they're taking care of one another. So that's my own kind of trajectory. I don't know.
Your own. Now, also last year you had an election, and Jomo Kenyatta's son, Uhuru Kenyatta, was elected president. How are people dealing with that? Are they worried? Are they happy? Because Jomo Kenyatta had a lot of controversy around his presidency, but what is the feeling, do you think, in Kenya now?
Well, because I was in Australia and I came back only in November, so I missed the whole kind of season. But I think the feeling I had coming back was, I think your Michael Moore says, dude, what have you done to my country? That's what I've been asking Kenyans, what have you done to my country? One, but secondly, I think the other image that came very strongly, I still feel that way, that I'm wandering through, you know, Salvador Dali's perceptions of memory. A very surreal kind of landscape, and I'm nervous about the new silences. I am very nervous about that, and I wonder what that's about. I don't know if I'll be here long enough to try to get to the essence of that. And I'm curious where those silences have come from, and why they have emerged again. So I think we're living in interesting times, certainly in this country. It'll be interesting to see what unfolds.
Yes, it always is interesting to see what unfolds around the globe or with people. But I just want to mention you did a beautiful job with the story. I'm sure you needed to go dip yourself in a pool after writing such an immense novel to refresh yourself from dust, if you will.
Thank you. You are so kind. Thank you for saying that.
I'm going to be giving away some copies of your novel. It's not coming out till the 27th, correct?
Until the 28th, yes.
Oh, the 28th. Okay. So I will be giving away some copies of the novel to the listeners. Thank you so much for taking the time all the way in Kenya to speak to me here in America. I really appreciate this, and also that you wrote the book, a beautiful novel. It's beautiful.
Thank you. Thank you so much for your kindness and for this interview as well.
Well, you have a beautiful day in Kenya, nice and warm, and I'll be nice and cold here waiting for a storm with snow.
I will export, so I'll email you some sunshine.
Yes, please do. Please do. Okay, you have a beautiful day, okay?
Thank you, and you too.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Thank you for tuning in. That was an interview with award-winning Kenyan author Yvonne Adhiambo Uwor about her book Dust. I will be giving away copies, as I stated, of the book, so follow me at Joy Keys on Twitter or become a fan on Facebook or tag me in a photo on Instagram. I hope you have a wonderful day. Thank you for tuning in.